Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Most of the big banks didn't ask for bailout money. They got a take-it-or-take-it proposition from the Treasury Department. But now they, and a lot of companies that have taken it since, are having some second thoughts. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 11th of March, and it's great to have you with us, as always. The guy in charge of the government's $700 billion bank bailout had a warning for Congress today. Don't force banks to make loans that they, that is the banks, think are too risky. Neel Kashkari is a holdover from the Bush administration. Former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson hired him to run the TARP back in October. Today, though, he was on the receiving end of House members telling him they're not happy with how banks are spending their money. When it was his turn, he channeled the banking community right back to them about all the strings attached to the TARP money and the anger that has convinced some banks to just want to give the money back. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
So far, 489 of the nation's 8,000 banks have taken money from the Treasury. But Neel Kashkari says members of Congress need to back off telling banks how they should be using the cash.
However well-intended, government officials are not positioned to make better commercial decisions than lenders in our communities.
Even if those lenders spent money on executive bonuses or company golf tournaments? Well, remember, not all the banks who got TARP money wanted it. They were asked to take it so no one would know which banks really needed it. And now, says analyst Andy Stapp at B. Riley,
they're all getting painted with the same brush, and it's just not the case.
The banks lining up to give the money back range from small players like Iberia Bank of Louisiana to big dogs like Goldman Sachs. Karen Petru is managing director of Federal Financial Analytics in Washington.
The stigma attached to TARP money grew ever more costly, leading the banks who felt forced to take it in the first place to say, I want to give it back, and I want to give it back now.
Well, maybe not now. Of the handful of banks who want to return the TARP funds, not all have a check ready.
Some want to give it back all at once right away. Others do want to phase it out to give them that capital buffer to support new lending if loan demand spikes before their ability to recapitalize improves.
In other words, would 12 easy payments of $20 million do? But we'll take our bank back now, if that's okay. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It's not just Bush administration programs that banks aren't thrilled with. They've been waiting a month now for details about current White House plans to fix the banking system. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner went on the Charlie Rose show last night, where he offered more of what we already know, that he hopes private investors are going to lend a hand and buy up some of those bad assets. We asked Marketplace's Steve Henn if there are any takers yet.
Last night, Tim Geithner told Charlie Rose the obvious. Our banking system's a mess. But
it's very important people understand it's going to take some time to work through this.
Geithner's plan to buy hundreds of billions of dollars of troubled assets from banks isn't new. But 6 months into this financial crisis, it still hasn't happened because
the pricing issue remains.
Daryl Duffy at Stanford says if the government pays too little for troubled mortgages and assets, banks could fail. If it pays too much, taxpayers lose. That's why Secretary Geithner's hoping to partner with private equity investors.
Private equity groups are good at figuring out what value assets have.
Josh Lerner teaches finance at Harvard.
Private equity is all about buying assets cheap. But on the other hand, there's also, particularly in a market like today's, some very reasonable caution about coming in too early and essentially getting burnt.
Investors wouldn't go on tape, but a few said they won't buy assets without some government guarantees. They want low-interest loans. They want the government to limit their losses. And they want to know the rules of this game won't be changed.
Of course, if the government is extremely generous, there'll be plenty of participation.
But Duffy says taxpayers would bear most of the risk.
And the taxpayers might not get a good deal. So you want to be very careful because you've got some very sharp investors out there who will be watching.
A little mistake could cost the government a fortune. So Duffy says it may actually be a very good thing that Geithner's taking his time working out the details. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
President Obama signed a $410 billion spending bill for the rest of the fiscal year this afternoon, but he wasn't too happy about it.
I am signing an imperfect omnibus bill.
Too many earmarks, he said, so he's laying down a marker of his own.
But I also view this as a departure point for more far-reaching change.
That was his polite way of saying he's fed up and he's not going to take it anymore.
In my discussions with Congress, we have talked about the need for further reforms to ensure that the budget process inspires trust and confidence instead of cynicism. So I believe as we move forward, we can come together around principles that prevent the abuse of earmarks.
No real response from members of Congress on that one yet, except for John McCain, who said he should have vetoed the whole thing and then seen what Congress did about it. No matter which end of the economic equation you are on, buying or selling, these days it's all about price. Luxury retailer Neiman Marcus reported a $500 million quarterly loss this morning. Might have something to do with all those $3,000 purses and $600 pairs of shoes still in the stockroom. Walmart, Target, and Kmart, meanwhile, have been doing brisk business. Still, some marketers are bucking the cheaper is better trend. Take, just for example, Procter & Gamble. It's betting that it can clean up on the smaller luxuries in life, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
You've already traded in fancy restaurants for mac and cheese. That trip to Italy looks fabulous on the Travel Channel. That new cashmere sweater, let's see what we can find in the closet. But Procter & Gamble has a luxury proposition for tough times. High-end Tide, or Tide Total Care. The message in a new ad campaign, spend a little extra taking care of the clothes you've got, because they may have to last you a while. Kevin Crociata is a marketing director with Procter & Gamble.
It actually has helped us to be in this environment when people aren't buying new clothes as often. They are taking care of them longer, and this product fits right into those new routines that consumers are adopting because of the economic times right now.
Fashion guru Tim Gunn is the face of the campaign.
Few things are more tragic than watching a fabulous essential die a slow death in the wash. Tide Total Care. It goes beyond cleaning to help keep your clothes like new.
Woolite is launching a similar campaign this week called Find the Look, Keep the Look, complete with their own style advisor, Stacey London. But will people really spring for premium laundry detergent? Tide Total Care is more expensive than regular Tide, which is already one of the highest-priced detergents on the market. Retail consultant Bert Flickinger thinks consumers will respond to that value proposition.
We're definitely expecting to see quote-unquote value campaigns on premium brand products that justify their premium price points.
Flickinger says with many people's investments down the drain, they're investing in what they've already got, hoping to make it work until the economy recovers. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Yesterday, it was Citigroup claiming its turn to profit. Today, it was JP Morgan Chase. CEO Jamie Dimon said this afternoon he's in the black through the first 2 months of the year. Didn't do Wall Street any good, though. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The enduring tension between labor and management has made its way to Capitol Hill. The Employee Free Choice Act was introduced in Congress yesterday. If it does become law, it would protect workers' rights to organize. That's not necessarily a popular idea with everybody, and even including some Democrats. Opponents of the bill say a recession is the wrong time to make unions stronger. Commentator Robert Reich says au contraire.
The way to get the economy back on track is to boost the purchasing power of average Americans. One way to do this is to expand the percentage of Americans in unions. Go back 50 years, when America's middle class was growing and the economy was soaring. Good pay meant more purchases, and more purchases meant more jobs. At the center of this virtuous circle were unions. In 1955, more than a third of working Americans belonged to one. Unions gave them the bargaining leverage they needed to get the paychecks that kept the economy going. But now, fewer than 8% of private sector workers are unionized. Middle-class wages slowed so much in the intervening years that most Americans could maintain spending only by working more hours, and then this decade, going deep into debt. But then the bubble burst, and now there's not enough purchasing power to keep the economy going. The decline of unions is not the only reason for the long-term slowdown in American wages. Much of what Americans used to make can now be made more cheaply abroad or by automated machines. But the vast personal service sector of the economy is not affected by imports or automation, including millions of jobs in big-box retailers, fast food outlets, hotel chains, hospitals, construction, and transportation. Few of these jobs are unionized. All too often, that's because employees who want to form unions are threatened by their employers. And if they don't heed the warnings, they're fired, even though that's illegal. I saw this behavior when I was Secretary of Labor over a decade ago. We tried to penalize employers that broke the law, but the fines are minuscule. Too many employers consider them a cost of doing business. The most important feature of the Employee Free Choice Act toughens penalties against companies that violate their workers' rights. The sooner it's enacted, the better. For American workers and for the American economy.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. We'd love your thoughts, should you be interested in sharing. Send them to us online. Our website is marketplace.org. This comes a day late to do much help if you're looking for work, but FedEx Office, which used to be known as the copying giant Kinko's, offered free resume copying yesterday. The company said it's just trying to be responsive to the troubles in the economy. It's kind of interesting because FedEx is one of the barometers that the Federal Reserve uses to measure the health of that economy. Ben Bernanke and his staff keep a close eye on the company's shipping orders, helps them get a sense of the flow of goods through the system.
The boss will see you now.
And so today on Conversations from the Corner Office, FedEx founder and CEO Fred Smith. He started the company almost 40 years ago based on a term paper he wrote while he was in college. Today the idea is in that paper, and he says he doesn't remember what grade he got, are at the core of what's become one of the world's biggest shipping and logistics companies and a key economic indicator all of its own. So that's what I asked him about first.
Well, business is definitely slow compared to where it was, say, a year ago. But having said that, I'm an optimist overall. I don't think the economy is going to drift into a depression.
Well, now, I have to say, you were quoted last year. I mean, I read a bit about this. You said, middle of last year, you said, nah, I don't think we're in a recession yet.
Well, that's right. I didn't think we were in a recession. And when I said it, I didn't think that fuel was going to run to $147 a barrel. And people forget this because so much focus has been on the financial sector. And clearly it was over-leveraged, and we backed into this subprime mortgage business and all of these derivatives and so forth. But the match that lit the tinderbox was the run-up in oil prices, because what it did was to make the subprime borrower literally have to choose between putting the gasoline in the car and going to work or making the mortgage payment.
As long as we're talking about the economy and how things stand, what do you think of the president's stimulus plan?
I think the president's stimulus package, which I think in all fairness might equally be called the congressional stimulus package, because a great deal of it was crafted by the House and in the Senate, I think it does not put enough emphasis on the industrial economy and try to get it back into a mode where it's making equipment and software purchases, because that's basically what drives the employment numbers. It's the locomotive of the big economic train. And so I don't think it does enough in that regard. I think that one of the things the president has to address is the movement over the past quarter century of our economy into a more than healthy reliance on the financial sector. The financial sector is a supporting activity, you know, that finances cars and businesses and so forth. And it's not an end of and to itself, but it became one with a lot of the financial engineering and that type of endeavor.
There's a tendency to look toward FedEx as an indicator of the overall economy. I imagine there are data streams going into your office by the hour every day. What do you look at on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis to figure out how your company's doing so that we can figure out how you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, our traffic statistics and probably UPS's traffic statistics together are as good a plebiscite on the economy on any given day, and what our customers are telling us are probably as good a forecasting mechanism as you can think of. So we do have a very good view of the economy and a generally effective feel, if you will, for where it's headed, I think.
So how are you feeling?
Well, I think the deleveraging that's taken place and the inventory bleed off that will take place, it's already taken place because so many people stopped buying things in the fourth quarter. By the time you get into the summer and people start buying things for the next holiday season, I think you'll start to see people have to reorder, and that will be the impetus on the way up. Now, the financial sector problem is the numbers are so big that if you talk about a bad bank or an aggregator bank, I mean, you're not talking about a few hundred billion dollars, which used to be an enormous amount of money. These days, it sounds like pocket change what the Congress is talking about, but you're talking about trillions of dollars to take these so-called toxic assets off of the balance sheets, and therein becomes the problem, just the enormity of it.
Fred Smith is the founder. He's the chairman, the CEO, and the president as well of FedEx. Mr. Smith, thanks a lot for your time.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
There are conversations from other corner offices on our website. You can hear them at marketplace.org. Coming up in Africa, survival trumps sustainability.
The vast majority of Tanzanians don't have electricity, so 90% of us use charcoal because it's cheapest and it's easy.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yes, it's a two-day rally, but not much of one. The Dow Industrials inched up 3 points today, a tiny fraction of 1%, closed at 6,930. NASDAQ gained 13 points, 9 tenths percent, settled at 1371. The S&P 500 eked out 1 point, 2 tenths percent, 721 the number. Financials fueled the buying again today, but uncertainty about plans to save that particular sector kept the gains in check. J.P. Morgan Chase climbed 4 and 6 tenths percent after that Jamie Dimon announcement I told you about. Citigroup up another 6 and 2 tenths percent today. Morgan Stanley jumped up 8% today. Healthcare shares were a big drag on the market. McKesson, the largest American drug distributor, swallowed 17% today. Cardinal Health, they distribute pharmaceuticals and medical products, purged nearly 10%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
Marketplace Statebook. Here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases retail sales figures for February. State representatives join President Obama and Vice President Biden for a conference. They'll discuss how to spend the stimulus dollars effectively. And keep the pressure down is a slogan for this year's World Kidney Day. Organizers are referring to your blood pressure, of course. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke said it again earlier this week that he thinks the financial system has to be fixed before anything else in this economy can really get better. That was the idea behind the original TARP back in September, which has gone through a couple of changes since then, the latest of which is something known on the street as good bank, bad bank. Government and private investors buying up shares of some of those problem mortgage-backed securities and shifting them into some kind of aggregator bank that would leave only the good stuff and a functioning lending bank behind. Sheila Bair is the chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, one of the agencies that is in charge of regulating banks in this country. Good to have you with us.
Sure.
Let me see if I can clarify this just a little bit. what's going to happen here, no matter what you call it, bad bank or an aggregator or whatever, is that at least initially there is going to have to be more government money involved.
That's right. Initially there will be. So the government will provide financing to make these purchases. So they will make loans into the aggregator bank. And this is important to provide some degree of leverage to get the pricing at a more realistic level. Right now, because of the credit crisis, it's hard to get financing to purchase assets. And without financing, the prices offered are very low. So by providing the financing, you can get the prices at a more realistic level.
So the government puts some skin in the game. That convinces private investors to get in there, although we don't really know yet, do we, if it'll work?
Well, I think we've done a lot of research and analysis. We've talked to a lot of banks. We've talked to a lot of investors. We're working closely with Treasury, and I should say this will be a Treasury program. It will be facilitated under TARP, but we're all working closely together. And based on all of our indications, we think it will work. We think there is significant interest by many of the banks to have a facility where they could sell these assets, and we think there's significant interest among investors to buy these assets at a reasonable price so that there's good upside potential.
There is a supposition here, isn't there, that the toxic assets will eventually become non-toxic, for want of a better word, at some point, right?
Well, I think they will certainly worth more than the current valuations. I think that is the assumption, and I think that's true. I mean, at the FDIC, we sell troubled bank assets all the time. You know, when we banks have to be closed, we take over as receiver. So we're pretty familiar with the market right now. So we think that that is absolutely true, that the assets are worth more than the current market conditions assigned to them. And so that, yes, over time, there will be significant profit from these.
When might we see some kind of progress on this? Because there has been talk of this for weeks now. The TARP has been in place for 6 months.
I think very soon. I think Secretary Geithner said within the next few weeks he hopes to announce this. So I think very soon.
Who's going to run this program, and how are we, the taxpayer, going to know whether it's working?
Well, I think that's still being discussed with Treasury. I think we all agree, though, this should be very transparent. There should be full disclosure of who the investors are, what the prices are. And I think that will be part of the benefit because we are trying to create a market for these assets. So you want transparency. You want the pricing out there so others can see what it is. So for it to work the best, I think you do need a high level of transparency, and taxpayers need to know. And I'm hopeful that those reports will show that taxpayers are making a healthy profit off this endeavor, and I think they will.
Sheila Bair, the chairwoman of the FDIC. Ms. Bair, thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was on Capitol Hill today. He's asking Congress to draft new laws on climate change. He wants to get the United States on board early with a global agreement the UN's going to try to hammer out later this year. Nearly 200 countries will be talking about curbing carbon emissions. Part of the problem, and there are many, many parts, of course, is deforestation in Africa. The UN says Africa's losing forests twice as fast as the rest of the world. And one reason is the continent's constant need for cheap energy, as Gretchen Wilson reports now from Tanzania.
On this street corner, men covered in black dust and sweat unload giant bags of charcoal from a truck and onto their shoulders. This charcoal has just come in from the bush, where it was made from fire, sand, and local trees.
We must pack our bags like this, full, full, full up to the top.
Charcoal vendor George Taimavora loads chunks of burnt wood into plastic shopping bags. One bag sells for about a dollar.
The vast majority of Tanzanians don't have electricity, so 90% of us use charcoal because it's cheapest and it's easy.
Charcoal burns longer and hotter than wood alone. It's what fuels many African homes and businesses, to heat buildings and to cook and boil water. At Innocence Restaurant, Maulidi Ali makes French fries over a charcoal flame.
I buy a little at a time because that's all I can afford. I need to buy more to make a big business.
But charcoal's production is unsustainable. Brad Smith is with Greenpeace.
Originally, there were about 7 million square kilometers of forest in Africa, and about a third of that is gone already.
A lot of it was used to make charcoal, according to the United Nations. Smith says the implications are huge.
Scientists are now in agreement globally that about one-fifth of all greenhouse gas emissions actually come from tropical deforestation. We really will not be able to get control of climate change unless we can address tropical deforestation.
That's no easy task. There's a rudimentary electricity grid, and most poor countries haven't developed alternative energy sources, like solar panels and wind farms. There are few jobs. Here, survival trumps sustainability. Logging is illegal in Tanzania's Ruvu South Forest Reserve, but only a few scrawny trees remain. The earth is covered in huge patches of black. Illegal loggers have formed a temporary camp here called Changiri. The shelters are made from ratty sheets and sticks. 28-year-old Ramadan Hamza Hamiz is a charcoal maker.
This job is too difficult to do. There's no one who wants to be here because we are here like animals, you know.
It's dangerous and blistering work for $60 a month. Hamiz says he'd rather work a legitimate job. But first, investors need to create them.
We want to go to disco, we want to have a good family. But because we don't have nothing to do, we decided ourselves to be here for some money.
And the reality is, Changiri and other charcoal camps are among the few economic engines around. But as science reveals the links between forests and climate change, Western countries are starting to throw millions of dollars at African governments. They're hoping Africa's leaders will better police protected forests and invest in energy alternatives. In Tanzania's Ruvu South Forest Reserve, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, a postscript to the Michael Phelps getting caught smoking pot story. Kellogg's, the cereal people, canceled his endorsement contract not long after that picture appeared. And we learned today where some of those boxes of Frosted Flakes and Corn Flakes with his face on them went. To a San Francisco food bank. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that 3,800 pounds of cereal was delivered to the local food bank a couple of weeks ago, which is great because food is food, but apparently it's really rare for those kinds of groups to get donations of cereal, perhaps because it costs like $5 a box. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow inched up 3 points, 0.6% to close at 6,930. The NASDAQ gained 13 points, 0.9%, 1,371 at the close. The S&P 500 gained a single point, 0.2%, wrapped up at 721. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, and Jeff Peters engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, what happens to university research in a recession?
Some of our companies that we've been working with have had to stop projects because of either funding difficulties or just uncertainty. So we've lost a few deals this year already because the businesses decided to put things on hold.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.